Hi, this is Josh Barrow. On Thursday, October 20th, KCRW is coming out of our basement studios for a civilized, yet provocative, Left, Right, and Center Live. Join us at the beautiful Ace Hotel Theater in downtown Los Angeles for a night of amusing and insightful commentary on this unique election season. I'll be joined by Kelly Goff, Gene Sperling, and Mona Charon as we dissect Trump versus Clinton, Democrat versus Republican, and fact versus fiction. Buy your tickets today at kcrw.com/LRCLive.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
Really, when you look at the sort of higher jobs, the head or executive chefs, only about 20% are women right now.
That's Deborah Harris. With Patty Giuffre, she wrote Taking the Heat, Women Chefs and Gender Inequality in the Professional Kitchen. We talked with her last year when the book was first published, but since inequality in professional kitchens remains a big issue, unfortunately, we decided there was more ground to cover.
So we did in-depth interviews with 33 women. They're in the Central Texas area, and all of them have been chefs, the heads of their kitchen at some point in their careers. Even though they're in Texas, they had experience working in a variety of kitchens all over the country. We were talking really about women who had both managerial expertise, so they were the ones in charge of staffing, and they also had creative control of the kitchen. So they had all been cooks and line chefs at some time, but they had worked themselves up to either being the head of the kitchen or, in some cases, the heads of pastry departments, so executive pastry chefs or something like that.
And when it comes to pastry chefs, what proportion of women chefs work in pastry kitchens versus work in the savory kitchen?
It's much more likely for women to go into pastries.
And why do you think that is?
You know, when we first started this, we thought it might have something to do with maybe women were being guided into that, maybe in culinary school. Maybe it had something to do with the thoughts of women being seen as there's something more feminine about desserts. But really, from the women we spoke to, it seemed to be a matter of personal preference. They had maybe grown up making cookies with family members. There's just something really about dessert that appealed to them personally. So it wasn't maybe that they're being steered that way, but that they really enjoyed the pastry work.
You know, one of the things that's always intrigued me about the lack of women in the kitchen is when you think about back in the day, at one point in our history as a country, most of the people cooking for paying customers were women. What changed?
Well, I think what we're seeing is the rise of the sort of elite, high-status restaurant culture in the United States. So I think we've had sort of this explosion of sort of fine dining, and so that getting a lot of the status. And at the same time, we've had that sort of coupled with more media attention. So right now, what we're focused on isn't the women cooking in the diners or the small family restaurants. We're really focusing in terms of sort of media representation at these elite fine dining restaurants that are pretty exclusively helmed by men.
You say that women's participation in the field has been marginalized and downplayed. What do you mean?
So really looking at this historically, so much of the attention has been put on men chefs and what they've been able to create. In the book, we sort of trace a little bit of the history, and we say there's always been what's called the haute cuisine versus home cuisine. So the idea of having the high-status cooking being sort of differentiated from the low-status cooking that women are doing in the home. And chefs did that, early chefs did that, to gain status for what they're doing, for their profession. And so we're finding that really looking at this, that sort of travels over. Even some of the most recent food trends, for example, like molecular gastronomy. So the idea of the chef as the mad scientist. So really taking cooking and making it as far from the home cooking, you know, the things that mom and grandma does as possible. So really showing that that's what should be honored and respected in the kitchen. And then the other sort of funny side of that coin is another big trend in food today is sort of nose-to-tail cooking. So taking what has traditionally been peasant cuisine cooked by mothers and grandmothers and really making it hyper-masculine. You know, all these pictures of the male chefs with like the cleavers, with a big pig thrown over their shoulder that they're about to butcher, you know, making it seem like hyper-masculine and a little bit gross sometimes, you know, with some of the things that they're doing in transforming these animals into food. So in that case, it's like they've taken something that's traditionally been done in the home by women, you know, using all parts of an animal, you know, which has been done for centuries, and they're like showing a way that it's professional and masculine and special, which is really ironic.
I'd love to talk a little bit about personality.
Mm-hmm.
Did you investigate at all what traits women need or that women have that sort of lead them into kitchen life?
Well, I think they're all very passionate about food. They love to feed people. They love to experiment with cooking. You know, they talk about thinking about food, you know, 24/7. You know, when they're awake, they're thinking about food. Sometimes they're dreaming about food. They love to explore new restaurants when they have time and their limited schedules. And they love to read about what's happening in the culinary world. So that passion has really, I think, led a lot of them into the food industry.
But to thrive in an environment that's kind of physically brutal and very inhospitable to a balanced life, you have to have a certain kind of drive.
Yeah. There's a lot of grit and determination. I mean, women, the stories they told were about constantly being tested, especially in their early days in the kitchen when they were first getting their job. So they had to really prove themselves and, you know, develop sort of a thick skin. One woman described it as having a leather back, you know, that, you know, no one could sort of pierce you with no matter what sort of barbs were throwing your way.
Is there a statistic on how many women drop out from the profession?
I would have to look that up. What we do know is we're seeing more and more women go to culinary schools. So we're seeing rates of 40, 50, 60% of culinary school graduates now are women, but that's not necessarily translating into going to work in restaurant kitchens. Now, again, some of that may be women, you know, they're choosing to go other paths. They want to work maybe for corporate chains, or maybe they want to work as caterers or personal chefs. So part of it may be them opting out sort of early on, but I think really what we're seeing more of is women getting into the field, working at it for a few years, and then dropping out. About half of the women that we studied, or a little over half, had actually left restaurant work behind when we interviewed them. And we were surprised by that. We thought, when we asked them, why did you leave restaurant kitchen work, we thought they'd say things like harassment or discrimination, but the number one thing was the work-family imbalance. And the women who were able to have families and to have some sort of semblance of family and work success, we found a couple of things. One, that maybe they had postponed having kids till they had gotten pretty high up in their restaurant. So either they're owners or they were, you know, maybe the sous chef. So they had proven themselves to the point that when they needed to take time off for family matters, they had that sort of cachet of goodwill, or that they were already owning their own restaurants.
I understand that in the process of doing the research you did a deep investigation into women mentioned in food media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we initially started off by interviewing women chefs about their experiences, but then we realized that another part of this picture of where women are able to succeed or not succeed in the industry related to the media. So we analyzed over 2,200 pieces of food media, and that included chef profiles and restaurant reviews from the New York Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, Food and Wine Magazine, and Gourmet Magazine. And we found that men and women chefs were talked about very differently. You know, first, just numerically, men were overall got the most focus. But then when you looked at sort of the tenor of the comments, a lot of times men were described as being these iconoclasts who broke all the rules and these rebels. It was very hyperbolic language. And women seemed to get more attention when they stuck to the rules. Like, this is classic Italian cuisine, and this is just like what my nonna used to make. That's really upholding this idea that what men do is new, exciting, and worthy of attention, versus women, well, it's kind of like the same old of home cooking. We also saw some big differences in some of the pictures. You know, there'd be more pictures of the women at the farmer's market picking up the flowers and the vegetables, and women sort of doing these very pretty portraits, versus they seem to be more pictures in the media of men doing actually action shots, like physically cooking, or the more masculine, you know, arms crossed across, you know, showing off the tattoos and the sleeves. So yeah, even the picture representations of men and women were very different.
That's Deborah Harris, author of Taking the Heat. Find a link to the conversation I had with her last year about gender inequality in the kitchen on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Next, we travel to one of my favorite countries in the world to hear about boozy cherries and preserving vegetables in oil. Don't turn that dial.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. The first time I ate eggplant preserved in oil, it was presented to me in the jar with a fork to fish out the slices. I took a bite and was kind of mystified. How was it possible to preserve such a unique and luxurious texture without the sharpness of vinegar? That was my introduction to the Italian pantry of preserving. Well, that and all the tomato sauce and olives I've consumed in my life. Now with her book, Preserving Italy, Domenica Marchetti shares this expansive tradition that's still very much alive in farmhouses and urban apartments all over Italy. You tell a story in your intro about the last time you and your sister ate your grandma's boozy cherries. Could you share it with us?
Yes, and that was really the inspiration for this book. So my grandmother used to put up sour cherries in alcohol, and she would sun-dry the cherries and marinate them in sugar and then add lots of alcohol and I think a splash of brandy. And of course, she never wrote down the recipe. So when she passed away, there were a few jars of these cherries left, and my mom and her three sisters guarded these jars jealously. And so the only time my sister and I were allowed to have our spoonful of amarena sotto spirito was when we had stomach cramps. So we had them quite often. And but they were sweet and tart and kind of chewy because they had been dried and very strong. And so that was kind of like an after-dinner treat every now and again. And I really wanted to recreate those cherries. And that's kind of what got me started down this path.
So I have to know, I should probably wait till the end to ask you, but I have to know now, were you ever able to recreate them?
I did. I had to make some adjustments. For one thing, we don't have the same sort of cherries here. We have the Montmorency pie cherries, and those are very good, but they're a little bit different than the very small, dark Amarena cherries. But I did make adjustments, and because I live in Northern Virginia and not Abruzzo, I can't dry cherries in the sun because sitting outside in the humidity of Northern Virginia, I would just get a tray of moldy cherries. So I improvised and used a low oven and dried cherries quite successfully. And then I kind of played around with the amount of sugar to add and the amount of alcohol. I know a lot of people use 100 proof vodka when they're making limoncello or other alcohol-based liqueurs or treats. I really decided to go with grain alcohol because I like that strength that it gives. And that seemed to do the trick. And I added a couple of glugs of cognac. And I think my grandmother would be happy with the results.
Oh, I think she would be thrilled that you even tried. Let's talk about this Italian tradition of preserving. Of course, in any culture, when there is abundance, there is this drive to preserve. It's just that Italians seem to do it like they do so many things with a particularly fantastic result. Could you talk about different categories that are different from the kinds of preserves that we know here in America?
Yes, of course we know jams and marmalades and jellies, and there's plenty of that in Italian preserving. The wonderful thing about Italy is it's a small country, but each region is vast, is kind of the way I think about it. And within these regions, there are so many microclimates, which is one reason why so much grows well in Italy. And as you know, where there is a plot of land, there is something growing on it. You know, they don't go for the big lawns like we like. So in addition to vinegar pickles, which we see a lot of in the U.S., The most traditional way that Italians preserve vegetables is in oil. And obviously, there's a lot of olive oil in Italy. A lot of families still have land with olive trees on them, and they make their own olive oil, and they use this for preserving. So it's a wonderful technique, and you can preserve a lot of vegetables with it. One way is to roast peppers, for example, and then skin them and marinate them in a vinegar brine. And this helps preserve them and kind of discourages the growth of any microbes. And once they've been marinated, you just put them in a jar and you fill the jar with olive oil. So you end up with these kind of vinegary, sweet and sour peppers that have a silky coating of olive oil on them. And so Italians do that not only with peppers, but also asparagus and artichokes and zucchini. So all of these wonderful garden vegetables get that silky olive oil treatment.
Now, when you make your vegetables in oil, do you end up canning them or do you keep them just in the fridge?
That's a great question. And I had to do a lot of careful research on this because the USDA doesn't actually have guidelines for preserving in oil. I just think there's not enough of it done in this country. So I decided not to water bath can the vegetables because I felt that even if the jars sealed, it might give people just kind of a false sense of security. And so what I ended up doing was treating the vegetables as the Italians treat them. So they're either dried, you know, if it's eggplant, you salt it and you dry it, then you marinate it, then you dry it some more, and then you submerge it in oil. So you've done several steps to preserve them properly and prevent the growth of microbes. So what I do is I just preserve them and I pop them in the fridge and they last, you know, for at least 3 months in the fridge. I know I have jars that have been in my fridge for quite a bit longer and the vegetables are perfectly fine, but I always like to err on the side of caution.
One of the recipes that I thought was so ingenious and surprising, and I sort of went, oh, of course, when I saw it, was the preserved garlic scapes that you make.
Yes. I love that recipe because it comes from one of my favorite cities in Abruzzo, which is the city of Sulmona. It's a beautiful medieval city that's ringed by mountains, and it happens to be the birthplace of Ovid the poet. It is also famous for its red garlic. And so if you go to the farmer's market that sets up in the piazza every day, you'll see fresh garlic in the early part of the year, and then in the fall, these braided strands of garlic. But in the spring, of course, there are the garlic scapes, and those are those swirly stalks. And so in Sulmona, they pickle the garlic scapes. And you'll find this at restaurants. They'll serve it as part of an antipasto with pecorino cheeses and salumi. And they're absolutely delicious. They're lightly pickled, and usually they cut them into about 2-inch pieces to make them more manageable. And they're brined in vinegar and then preserved in oil. And this is one of my favorite condiments because it's just something that's fun and easy to pull out, you know, if you're doing a last-minute cheese platter for friends. And I just love its connection to this part of Abruzzo.
Now, in addition to sharing the techniques and also sharing recipes that use some of these preserved items, you profile a few artisans. Could you talk about Genoa's pesto ambassador?
Yes, Roberto Panizza. He is, you know, a Genoan going back generations, and his family has owned a number of grocery stores in the city of Genoa, and he sort of became the ambassador for pesto by accident. But in the 80s and 90s, when all of these things were happening to pesto with, you know, sun-dried tomato pesto and artichoke pesto and this pesto and that pesto, he got a little bit turned off, and he really wanted to kind of preserve pesto, the traditional basil sauce that Genoa and Liguria are known for. And, you know, it's just garlic, olive oil, pine nuts, basil, and cheese at the end. And so he started producing pesto in one of his shops and selling it fresh. And then he started bottling it as well. But what he's really known for is kind of going around the world with his giant mortar and pestle and teaching people how to make traditional pesto. And every other year, he kind of hosts a pesto competition in Genoa. And it's a day-long event. And a number of judges whittle down the contestants from 100 people down to, by the end of the day, a final winner. And he's very precise about what kind of basil has to be used, where it's grown. One thing that was really important was you have to use very small leaves. So the basil is grown on the hillsides in the city of Genoa, up on the hills, in terraced plots. And it's harvested every 20 days in the summer. And the largest leaves are maybe as big as your thumbprint. Anything bigger is considered too mature and too bitter and too aggressive to turn out a really good pesto.
So fascinating. I'm thinking about where I live in California, which of course is the land of almonds. What can I do to preserve almonds?
You can make almond paste, which is, you know, not quite like marzipan, but I do have a recipe in the book for grinding almonds with sugar and making a nice kind of rustic paste, which you can use in baking. Sometimes I put almonds in honey, and you can kind of suspend almonds and other nuts in honey, and this is kind of a Piedmontese way to preserve nuts. Or one of my favorite things to do with almonds is to make orzata, which is an almond syrup. And you grind the nuts and you filter milk through these ground nuts, and you know, do that a number of times, and you end up with kind of almond milk, and you mix that with sugar, and it makes one of my favorite drinks, which is called orzata. So those are a few things you can do with your wonderful California almonds. How lucky you are to be out there.
Domenica Marchetti's new book is Preserving Italy: Canning, Curing, Infusing, and Bottling Italian Flavors and Traditions. Now it's time for the Market Report. Take it away, Laura.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. It's so fascinating to watch the seasons at the farmer's market change. Sometimes you find something just at the end of the season and you wish it could be around a little bit longer. I'm happy now to be talking with Spencer Bazaar, who is the chef partner at L&E Oyster Bar in Silver Lake. Spencer, you gave the station an amazing recipe using an ingredient called hyssop. I think people don't know what that is. It's spelled H-Y-S-S-O-P. Tell us why you like this ingredient and how you're going to use it.
I like the versatility of the herb itself. In the restaurant, we make that Adriatic fig tart, which I gave the recipe for. But it's also used, you can flavor vinegars with it. We put it in a shaved asparagus salad at the restaurant as well. And it has a really nice sweet flavor and really minty overtones with a little bit of a anise kick to it at the end there. And it's very aromatic, and we even use it sometimes in mignonette sauce for oysters and that kind of thing, just because it's such a unique flavor and it stands out so much with other ingredients as well.
So the primary flavors are sort of mint and anise or licorice.
Sure, yeah. And also there's a lot of sweetness in the leaf as well. That's why I like it in salads, because it'll kind of cut the acidity a little bit and add a little bit of body and sweetness to the salad.
And I noticed this bunch you're holding right now has purple flowers on it. Do you use the flowers?
We do, yeah. They make pretty garnishes, but they also have that really nice anise flavor that it's nice on maybe on top of a little bit of a slice of blue cheese, honey, and a little bit of that flour is really nice.
Is it better to tear the leaves or cut them?
I like to tear them. Just kind of, it'll release a little bit of the oils out of the leaf itself. Mm-hmm. But the stems are also useful, too, if you want to make an anise-flavored honey or a vinegar of sorts.
So you'd use the stems for that?
Yeah, you can crush them up a little bit, or you can even put them all in a blender and then use a fine mesh strainer to strain it all out. So the essential oils kind of get encapsulated in the oil or the vinegars.
That opens up a whole world now to flavored vinegars and oils and honey.
Sure, sure. And the versatility of it is endless. You can make salad dressings. You can make it as a condiment. You know, it's really anything you want to do with it.
So now hyssop, sadly, we were talking to Bill Coleman. It's kind of getting to the end of the season. What would you suggest if people want to go out and try something like this to be a substitute?
I mean, there's a lot of flowering basils that are going on right now. You have Thai basils. Also, a lot of mints are coming this season, too. You have a lot of chocolate mints and those kind of things.
Do you want to kind of walk us through the process of making that fig tart?
For the fig tart that we use in the restaurant, we use right now the Adriatic figs, but that season's coming to a close, and those are the green ones with the pink on the inside. But Black Mission figs are still prevalent, and you could easily substitute the Black Mission for the Adriatic fig. So it's the fig filling that we add in a little bit of chopped hyssop leaf itself into it. And it is garnished with a whipped goat cheese that we use a little bit of heavy cream, goat cheese, and whip it up. So it gives a little bit of a savory note and otherwise be a sweet tart. And that anise flavor from the hyssop kind of lends itself to that goat cheese. And then we drizzle with a little bit of a honey and then toasted pine nuts to kind of bring back those earthy undertones of the fig and the hyssop and also the goat cheese.
And it sounds like the herb is kind of like the key ingredient.
Yeah, I think we put it in the tart and also in the honey that's drizzled on top, and then it's garnished with the actual flour. So there's a lot of hyssop going on in that dish.
Okay. All right, well, that sounds fantastic. Thank you so much, Spencer, and thanks for helping us understand more about hyssop.
My pleasure, absolutely. Thank you so much.
That was Spencer Bazaire. He is chef partner at L&E Oyster Bar. We didn't talk much about oysters, but apparently Spencer knows more about oysters than anybody, so head on over there for oysters and hyssop and whatever else he's got cooking. We were talking a minute ago about the seasonality of hyssop, and so we figured the best thing to do might be to try to grow your own. And so Shawn Fulbright is here. She owns Mono Farm, and she sells seeds under the All Good Things Organic Seeds label. And her table is covered with seed packets, including three different kinds of hyssop, a purple flower, a pink flower, and a white flower. So if we were going to grow our own hyssop, can you tell us what the best way is to proceed, and when could we expect some blooms?
Well, you can start your seed anytime between now and next spring. The sooner the better, probably, because it'll have all winter to get established. And then the plants can really start to leaf out and flower up in the spring and summertime of next year. So you can start harvesting maybe May, June, all the way through August or September.
And then you said it's a perennial. Does it?
Yes.
So then it'll just bloom every year in the summer?
Yes. If you live anywhere in this area in California where you're not going to get a total ground freeze, you can grow hyssop year after year, and it'll flower year after year. So you can just cut back the blooms, and then it'll reflower again the following year.
Right. And so what is it about hyssop that makes you want to grow it, and why do you like it?
I like it for its fragrance and for its ease of growth in the garden. It's relatively drought tolerant. It's very low maintenance. It's decorative, but it's also useful. It attracts beneficial insects and a lot of pollinators. So it just adds a nice diversity to the garden.
You primarily grow these things to collect seeds for your seed company. How do you collect the seeds, say, for example, from hyssop?
So what we would do is we would let them bloom without cutting any of the flowers. We would let them bloom until they begin to brown and dry out, which is right around now. And then we come through and do a big harvest of all of the flower heads at one time.
I've been to your farm, and I must have been in the heavy seeding stage, and like all the plants look dead. And I was looking, and I'm like, this doesn't look like a farm. But you were saying, no, it's perfect. All the seeds are ready to harvest.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. And then we come through and we process by hand. So we just are rubbing the seed heads together, getting all the seeds to pop out of their little shells. And then we screen them, and then we winnow them with a fan to get all of the chaff out.
And then count 200 and put them in a bag.
Exactly. One by one.
You said you're developing another kind of hyssop?
Well, we're not developing it. It's just a variety that we've had in the past that is sold out of our catalog right now. And it's called anise hyssop, which I think is one of the more popular culinary varieties. So that one tends to sell quite fast for us.
All right. And when are those seeds going to be ready?
Those should be ready probably by November, December. It really depends on how the plants are developing in the field.
Okay. All right. And then you grow how many kinds of seeds?
Oh, my. Our catalog is comprised of about 150 different kinds of seeds that we've grown over the years that we have and are selling now. This summer, we're growing about 20 varieties in the field that we're harvesting, been harvesting since the springtime, and we'll be finished harvesting probably in November, December.
Okay. And what are your top sellers?
Our top sellers tend to be comfrey, which is a popular permaculture herb. And then we also sell a lot of hibiscus, the culinary hibiscus. And then smoking tobacco, surprisingly, is a very popular seller. Burdock root, stinging nettle. A lot of our specialty items are more in the realm of medicinal herbs.
That was Shawn Fulbright. She is a seed grower at Mono Farms in Ojai, and she sells the seeds under the label All Good Things Organic. You can find them around town. They've got beautiful, bright labels. And she comes to the Wednesday market on a sort of an alternating week basis right now. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
You can find out more about hyssop on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, we debate the merits of square versus round pies, among other intrinsic qualities of pie. That's in honor of our annual pie contest tomorrow. Stay with us.
Check out KCRW's all news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
In the grand scheme of life, there's only a few categories of food, and pie is one of them.
That's Dan Pashman, the host of WNYC's podcast about all things food called The Sporkful. He joins me to take on that loaded question, what is a pie? Hi, Dan.
Hey, Evan.
Before we start, I have to state a kind of disclaimer. Our discussion is for philosophical purposes only and does not necessarily reflect qualifications for entering the Good Food Pie Contest.
You mean I wore these judges' robes for nothing? I got all dressed up.
First, what are some of the characteristics that you think every pie must have?
Well, the most important thing it must have is a bottom crust. And the bottom crust must hold fillings of some kind. I think those are the two most basic qualifications of a pie.
I love it. I've heard you call it an encasement.
Well, you know, that's an interesting question because, like, to me, a wrap or a burrito is an encasement. We don't need to go all the way back into our wrap versus burrito debate, Evan, but a pie to me is slightly different. To me, an encasement sort of completely encloses a filling and is sort of more portable, as I think of it, whereas a pie is sort of more like the crust is kind of like a tray. It's almost like in place of a plate. It's like an edible plate that contains fillings. I don't think you have to have a top crust to have a pie. And so if there's no top crust, it's not an encasement.
Okay, but it has to have sides, right?
Yes, it needs to contain the filling. And some fillings might be more or less viscous. If it's possible for your pie fillings to run off of the crust and hither and thither, well, that's not a pie. That's just sort of like a big cookie with stuff on top.
Okay, now, do you have an opinion about whether or not the sides must be angled or if they may be straight?
I think they can be straight. I think that's a stylistic difference.
Okay, then it's not a pie.
Oh, why? Why not?
Then it could just be like a cake, or it could be a cheesecake, for example.
I mean, all right, we got to unpack that just a little bit here, Evan. Slow down, okay? I mean, I don't really think there's a material difference between the angle of the sides. I do actually think that a cheesecake is a misnomer. I think a cheesecake is a pie, but cake has to have cake in it, and cake is cake. It is a sweet bread-like product that is distinguished from a pie.
I would agree with you about cheesecake because in other cultures, like for example, in Italian, it's called a ricotta pie, but I would like to see it in a pie pan rather than in a springform pan, but that's an actual doer's situation rather than a commentator situation. And I think of you as a food pundit, not necessarily a cook.
That's fair. I will take that label.
Okay. What do you think the difference is between, or do you think there's even a difference between a pie and a tart and a galette?
Well, there is a difference. The question is, are tarts and galettes still pies? I would say that a tart is a pie. It's sort of like a redheaded stepchild in the pie family tree. But it has the basic characteristics of a pie. It has a bottom crust with walls that contain a filling. A galette, I want to say that a galette is a pie. My concern, though, is that once you just start talking about taking dough and folding in the edges and having filling in the middle, now we get into dangerous territory. Why isn't a pizza eligible for your contest then, in that case? So many foods could be in your competition if a galette is eligible. So I have real reservations about it.
You know, we had a galette win once.
I know.
And Jonathan was just horrified. that being Jonathan Gold.
Right, sure. No, I mean, I'm sure he's listening to this conversation driving around Boyle Heights somewhere right now, and it's giving him agita as we speak.
But I have to say that I disagree. I think a galette is a pie. I just think it's a lazy pie.
That's fair. I mean, if you want to say that every galette that gets entered in the contest is going to get an automatic minus one because the same level of craft is not required, I'm okay with that.
But then going back to the tart, I would say that a tart definitely isn't a pie. And these are my reasons. Typically, a tart has a very thin crust. And often for a tart, because it's a different shape and it's often baked in a tart pan, which can be taken away, so the crust has to actually stand on its own and not be supported by a dish. Often it is a different kind of crust. It's a shortbread or a cookie crust, which I don't think of as a pie crust. And second, I don't think it has the correct ratio because of this. There's not the correct filling to crust ratio in a tart. It's like all filling and just here's a little crust.
I mean, I understand your argument intellectually, but I feel like the differences that you're pointing to are more like stylistic differences between different types of pie. If you're going to start to say that at a certain point the filling to crust ratio crosses the line at which it ceases to become pie, then you need to quantify exactly where that line is. And that's a hard thing to do. If you're going to say that the exact materials in the crust can make it leave pie territory. I mean, so now a key lime pie with graham cracker crust, what is that? A lot of these are gray areas. And I think that when we seek to make a definition, you know, you have to kind of separate yourself. We have to separate ourselves from the biases that we all bring to these questions of like our personal preferences. For instance, to bring back one of your and my favorite debates, Evan, is a burrito a wrap? You love burritos. And I think that sometimes you let your, with all due respect, I think that sometimes you let your personal preferences alter your more objective judgments about definitions.
I can understand what you're saying. I disagree respectfully, but I understand. However, in this instance, it's called a pie contest, not a tart contest. I always just say to contestants who want to win, not just want to put forward what they think of as their best baked item. If they want to win a pie contest, I just don't think the judges are ever going to choose a tart. However, people are free to enter them. We don't stop them at the entry table and say, that is a tart, go to the back of the line.
Right. You accept all entrants, but they're not all created equal.
Well, I mean, the judges, of course, will bring their own set of biases to the judging process, which is why I'm not a judge.
Right.
What can I tell you? But I do want to say that I believe a key lime pie is a pie, because most of the key lime pies we see at the contest are presented in pie pans. Although I can remember a few that have been brought in tart pans, they haven't won. Neither has a key lime pie, actually. So we'll see. There's always a possibility for the future.
That's right. I just feel like the shape should not be the determining factor. Because if you're going to start to say that it's the shape, it was brought in a pie tin, oh, well, it's round, oh, well, the crust is so thick, then it's like, you know, you're opening up a huge can of worms. Then half the galettes aren't eligible, but half of them are. We need objective criteria.
So tell me about your square pie.
Okay, so my opinion, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this, Evan. You know, I like to think a lot about where in a slice of pie do you get the best bite? And I believe that it is at the exact spot where the vertical side crust and the outer perimeter of the bottom crust meet. Because you get some crust that has absorbed some filling through gravity. You have some side crust that's a little bit drier and going to be a little firmer and add texture. And then you get some filling in there. That's the money bite right there. And with a square pie, you get more of those bites than you do with a round pie.
That's true. I have to say, having watched the video, and also the fact that you can cut it more easily in a way, describe the differences in cutting a round pie or the square pie.
Yeah, I mean, you could cut it sort of in a tic-tac-toe fashion, and then you get the one if you have a person who doesn't like crust, a filling person, they get the middle. Or you could cut it a sort of Union Jack style, you know, an X and a plus. And in that case, you will get pretty equal slices with pretty equal amounts of that rear crust filling combo and more per slice than you would get in a round pie. You get a higher ratio of the bites towards the back of the crust than you do in a typical round pie.
Yeah, I'm a traditionalist, so, you know, of course, I'm going to go for the round pie. But just out of curiosity, sometime this summer, I'm going to bake a square pie and see what it's like.
I appreciate how open-minded you are, Evan.
Thank you.
I'm curious to hear how that comes out.
Because, after all, there's no pie that isn't an edible pie when it comes down to it.
That's true. I mean, in the grand scheme of life, there's only a few categories of food, and pie is one of them.
Absolutely. If you want a piece of pie personally, if you're not breaking it down as a pie pundit, are you a cream pie person, a fruit pie person? What is your preference?
I mean, I love a pecan pie, a fruit pie or a pecan pie. I want some texture in there. I love a crumb topping. One of my all-time favorite pies is like a blueberry crumb pie with a nice crumb topping, and I love really good vanilla ice cream with the pie. So I like there to be some light crunch from the crust, either a crumble topping or a crunch from the nuts, and then the creaminess from the ice cream. And I like my pie room temperature or a little bit cold.
You are my kind of guy. Who knew that we would agree on anything?
There you go. See, Evan, there's hope for us yet.
So the next time you're in LA, let me know and I will bake you my boysenberry lemon quark, which is kind of like a cream cheese crumble pie.
Oh my stars. That sounds amazing. Hang on. I'm booking the flight. Here I am. I'm on my lap. Okay. All right. I'll be there tomorrow.
Before we wrap this up, I want to ask you about hand pies.
Yes. Oh, that's a tough one. Okay, go on.
Yeah. Do you think they're on equal footing as traditional fruit pies?
I think you can make a better case that a galette or a tart is a pie than that a hand pie is a pie. Because a hand pie doesn't have that element of the bottom crust that sort of acts as a tray that holds and contains fillings. A hand pie to me is more like a wrap. It's more like an encasement because it's not like the bottom tray that is filled and then possibly topped. It's almost more like a dumpling or something. I think that making a great hand pie probably has a different set of challenges than making a traditional pie. I don't think the fact that it's smaller should diminish the level of difficulty, but I have real concerns about allowing it into the contest on definitional grounds.
I love this. I feel like we could go on forever.
I know, seriously. How much time you got?
Thank you so much, Dan.
My pleasure, Evan. Good luck with the contest. Keep me posted.
I will for sure. Dan Pashman's the host of the Sportful podcast from WNYC Studios, available wherever you get your podcasts. The conversation I had with him is part of KCRW's podcast, which you can also listen to on our website or find on iTunes. And if you're in Los Angeles, I expect to see you on Sunday at our pie contest. The doors open at 11 a.m. at UCLA's Royce Quad. You can expect to try literally hundreds of different kinds of pie there, so start your fast now. There's also lots of opportunities to browse a marketplace, eat at food trucks, just have a lot of fun at UCLA's Royce Quad. Next, we pay homage to the most humble of all tacos. That's when the show continues.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program Morning Becomes Eclectic can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. Remember those hard-shell tacos of your youth? I have to say that a couple times a year, I cave and I make them. Mine are filled with white meat chicken, topped with shredded lettuce, shredded cheddar, tomatoes, and hot sauce. Even with the ascendance of the soft taco, those hard shells can still create a powerful craving. In honor of next Tuesday's National Taco Day, we asked LA Weekly food writer Garrett Snyder to join us and to enlighten us on a very specific kind of taco, the gringo taco. I never knew that it was called that.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's a really vague term. I know Gustavo Arellano, who wrote a fantastic book called Tacos USA, calls them gabacho tacos, which is kind of another term for kind of white folks. People call them white boy tacos or whatever you want. I mean, basically, they're kind of the general Mexican-American taco that you kind of have in your mind at, you know, various fast food places or things like that.
Are most of the places we can get them in L.A. stands?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the reasons I was really attracted to the idea of them was because they kind of embody the kind of 50s, 60s roadside stand culture. And that's kind of what they're most associated with. And really, they're kind of a dying breed. So some of the places that I wrote about predated Taco Bell, Del Taco. So they're firmly embedded in SoCal culture, and they're really kind of part of this identity that's developed for, you know, people here.
And if there was any even hint that they were closing, they would have people around the block.
Oh, it's already happened. I mean, Henry's Tacos a couple years ago, there was a big kind of protest over, you know, they were being forced out by high rent and development and kind of all the things that we've come familiar with here in Los Angeles. You know, there was people that signed a petition, like Elijah Wood and Georgia Lopez were on board, and, you know, the lines around the block. And, you know, I covered that for the Weekly as well. And, you know, it was kind of surreal because people really have these decades-old memories of their fathers taking them there, you know, their grandparents, whatever. And it relocated, and, you know, it lost its kind of beautiful, Googie-inspired stand, and, you know, but it's open, I think, maybe less than a mile away, and it's still packing them in, you know?
So is there a template for all of these tacos? I mentioned that my sort of memory, hard shell taco, is a chicken taco, but a lot of these stands make a different kind of taco.
Yeah, I think there is kind of a general blueprint. I think that the Gringo taco is kind of like the prefab home of tacos in some way. It's like, you know, you have the crunchy tortilla shell that's almost like a tortilla chip that's been, you know, shaped into a really steep U. You have the kind of ground beef usually that's been kind of cooked down to almost like a sloppy Joe texture, that really, you know, sharp cumin-y sauce. I know other people will, or other stands will do kind of a braised chicken dish as well. And then you gotta have the yellow shredded cheese. Yellow orange, I guess, is the best way. You know, it's like kind of like cheddar, but no one's shipping that from England. Like, it's not that legit cheddar at the cheese store. It's just like cheddar product, which is, I think that's actually kind of perfect. It's almost the right amount of fakeness, you know?
It has to be there.
Oh, it has to, yeah. I mean, without it, you know, it's almost like a visual thing, too, which is a nice little pop with the little red of the tomato. I mean, if Andy Warhol was still around, he would definitely be making, you know, these Gringo taco portraits. I mean, it's really iconic.
And, of course, there always has to be that little crunch of the iceberg lettuce.
Yes, shredded iceberg lettuce. I make those a lot at home, too, and I used to, like, shred the iceberg lettuce, which seems really like an odd kitchen chore. And then I found out that you can just buy pre-shredded lettuce for, like, a dollar in a bag. And I was like, well, I'll go with that.
Which is probably what all of these places
yeah.
do. So where do we go besides Henry's to find the remaining Gringo tacos in L.A.?
Well, you know, it's funny because when I wrote the article, I was thinking, oh, I'll do the 10 spots. And I'll do, like, a top 10 list. And I was like, well, I don't know if there's actually 10, like, legitimate places that I would want to put on the list. I mean, it was I could count them on, you know, less than two hands. And one of the places that stood out was a little spot called Taco Fiesta, which is kind of in Mount Washington area, just north of Dodger Stadium. And for a long time, it was my personal secret spot that I never told anyone about because I was just kind of enamored of it. It's like this little spot in the corner of the parking lot of a supermarket. And it's half a donut stand, half tacos, and they also sell lottery tickets and cigarettes and just like a miniature bodega. And it's actually run by a Thai gentleman who I think they've been there since like the 70s. It's like the last vestige of a chain. And that's something you'll find a lot too, is these places used to be these like blossoming chains across the city. And then now there's like one location left like clinging on.
Yeah, they become kind of marooned.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're resistant to change, which is charming in its own way. And this place, I mean, yeah, like, you know, $1.75, $2, you get this really kind of hefty taco. The beef is just like classic, zesty, robust. Like, you'd never call it spicy. Like, you don't call Gringo tacos spicy, but there's kind of a zestiness to it.
Yeah, I always feel like the template is the Lowry's taco mix.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the dried little...
The seasoning packets.
Yeah,
yes.
The seasoning packets.
Those are magic, yeah. The other place, out in the SGV, you'll find some great kind of little neighborhood spots or, you know, spots that are beloved by locals that have been around for decades. And one of them is called Taco Lita. It's out in Arcadia, and it's the most beautiful building. Like, if LA Conservancy, like, isn't on saving it or, like, protecting it, then they need to get on it because it's this beautiful kind of mid-century, like, you know, neon stand that has a beautiful sign. You go, and it's, like, these red tile floors and, like, you know, yellow formica tables. Like, it's just, like, transporting to be in there. And, you know, it's another kind of chain that's on its last legs, you know, as far as locations. But, you know, they have their own little branded sauce packets, which is like, I grab as many as I can. They're delicious. The taco shells aren't as crisp as some places, but, you know, they make up for it in other ways. And then another place that almost made the list, but I had to be a little discerning, was a place called Taco Treat. And they actually, their tacos are pretty good, but they actually have a deep fried bean and cheese burrito that's like, it looks like a corn dog. It's like really long and like thin, and it's just, it's so delicious. You could just taste how terrible it is for you, but it's so good. And I was like, all right, we got to do a bean and cheese burrito roundup next.
It. Gotta love that. Now, what about the classic Tito's?
Oh, you know, it's funny. I didn't grow up in Los Angeles, but, you know, my fiance did and so many of my friends did, and they're really kind of divided on Tito's. And I don't understand. I mean, I think the people that don't like it just take for granted, like, how unique and how kind of awesome it is in its kind of, like, persistence to its ways. I think that's really cool. And one thing I joked about in the piece I wrote was, you know, they call it shredded beef, but it could almost be pre-chewed. It has that really weird texture where you're just kind of like, what are they doing back there? But I think they're delicious. And I love the watery salsa, like all these things, you just kind of embrace them. I mean, it's like one of those things. I'm sure other cities have their, you know, like Philadelphia has the kind of crappy cheese sticks that everyone loves.
Yeah,
you know?
It's like a memory touchstone. And there is always a line at that
always
place.
A line.
Always a yeah. line. Yeah. I have to say, I'm going to throw in a couple places that are different than your places.
No, please.
Just as a wild.
Yeah.
That are restaurants. And it's more the home style. So it's not like the nacho you.
Mm-hmm.
You understand that it's a regular corn tortilla.
That's been deep fried. And
that's been
in, yeah.
deep fried with the stuff with the toothpicks in it. So for me, it's Paco's Tacos.
Oh, yes. Yes.
On Centinela. They're really good. I think that's actually my touchstone for my own home style ones.
I love that these places have the names, like you can almost like know it before you hear it, like Pepe's and Paco's and like El Taco, just like proto Spanish, like just, you know, I think you can almost kind of hear it and be like, I bet that place has a pretty good hard shell taco.
Yeah, Gringolandia.
Yeah.
So National Taco Day is coming up next week. Do you have any plans?
I don't know. I guess maybe I will eat some tacos, but that's not too different from any other day for me. So I think it should be, you know, standard.
Do you have a favorite soft taco spot?
That's a tough one. You know, I am really in love with the tacos they do down in kind of South LA, South Central on the weekends. Tire Shop Taqueria. It's like beautiful carne asada on fresh, you know, fresh made tortillas. And that's like, that's the dream. So there's room for all types, is what I'm saying.
It's true. Garrett Snyder's a food writer for the LA Weekly. Find a link to his list of the best gringo tacos in LA on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
There really hasn't been a place in the neighborhood that would pay careful attention to like a shaved cauliflower salad seasoned with Bragg's nutritional yeast, which turns out to be a perfectly sensible umami bomb. I'm all for it.
That is LA Times food critic Jonathan Gold. He's talking about Winsome in Echo Park.
It's in the bottom of this giant complex, very 1960s. There's a big church that doesn't seem to be in use at the moment. There's what appeared to once have been Sunday school. There's a new luxury apartment or condo building. And at the base of it, almost where you'd figure that there would have been a, you know, arts and crafts room, is the restaurant, which is also tricked out in very sort of 1960s forward-looking fashion. There's a big patio. There's a big interior space. It feels a lot like a Googie coffee shop.
And then in the back, there's like a more formal, adorable dining room with a fantastic mural.
That's true. The mural is very interesting. It looks like it could be Echo Park Lake, but it's not
but
quite
it's not. Yeah.
Echo Park Lake. You look at it, it's printed wallpaper with palm trees and a lake on it.
And then it has that grab-and-go area in the front for pastry and cappuccino.
Yeah. Very early in the morning, people go for coffee stuff and things like brown butter mochi cake that are not so bad.
And so they're open for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Breakfast may have at least been the emphasis at the beginning. It made Bon App's list of the 50 best new restaurants in the country before it even opened for dinner.
Wow, that's impressive.
So he was probably taken by the rosti, which are potato pancakes, not especially crisp, which they will top with like big slabs of brisket or smear with tahini and avocado and then layer smoked salmon over. There's a vegetarian one, I think, with spinach and asparagus.
It's very good.
Yeah. If you are apt to have toast with a fried duck egg and cheese and andouille on it, you'll be very happy. It's a little bit hearty. The best thing that I've had at the restaurant, and I keep having it over and over and over and over again, is the semolina pancake.
I think I had that for breakfast. It was incredible.
It's sort of a broad pancake made with semolina and with buckwheat, sizzled on one side. The edges get really nice and crispy and buttery, but I don't think they flip it, so it's almost puddingy inside.
It's like a crumpet.
I suppose it could be like a crumpet because it has those holes all over it.
More to accept the melted butter.
They make strawberry preserves and they put them on top. And you almost want to push them to the side because the grain flavor, the buttery flavor of the pancake is just so good even without them.
But then you end up eating it anyway.
Of course you eat the preserves because they're preserves.
Yeah, of course. Who's the chef cooking all this food?
I think the chef of record is Jeremy Struble.
And he comes from?
Rustic Canyon. I'm just thinking about Rustic Canyon now. I'm getting hungry, even though I'm describing this other place that's also making me hungry. They opened for dinner fairly recently, and I was surprised that the aesthetic was pretty close to what it is at breakfast. It's not a we'll do breakfast for the locals and we'll do dinner for everyone else.
So it's a real neighborhood restaurant. What is another kind of main dish that you liked?
The whole roasted branzino. It's a big fish, and it's presented sort of butterflied, so you definitely see the spine and the skull, and then there's big sheets of boneless, crisp skin, you know, nicely done meat on either side. It feeds a lot of people. It's a big fish. The roasted chicken is nice. It's a simple prep, but it's like, again, rubbed with herbs. A good thing to pretend that you're going to eat when really what you want are the Kennebec potato chips, which are thick, cooked to order, sprinkled with herbs, and are so, so good.
Wow.
Or, you know, a dish that I really like of pork short ribs that are rubbed with spice, including what must be super expensive amounts of fennel pollen, and then roasted, and they're crisp and they're sort of melty on the inside, and the fennel is super intense, and it goes really nicely with some of the aromatic natural white wines that they tend to serve.
And I bet the dessert menu must be pretty great too.
The desserts aren't bad. There's a kind of baked Alaska.
Really?
But they call it Baked Japan. So there's like this, you know, big ball of meringue surrounding coffee ice cream. There's miso caramel.
That sounds wonderful.
It's a good thing.
Jonathan Gold is the Pulitzer Prize winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Winsome in Echo Park. Text the words good food to 69866 to get more weekly restaurant recommendations. That's it for this week's show. Go to kcrw.com or download our mobile app to listen to the show. You can also find our podcast and the second installment of a bonus podcast devoted to pie on iTunes. It's called the Good Food Pie Cast. And if you'd like to engage with pie IRL in real life, come tomorrow to the 8th Annual Good Food Pie Contest. All the festivities start at 11 a.m. at UCLA's Royce Quad. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team. That's
Abby Fentress Swanson, Laurel Garcia,
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby, here's mine. Camellia Say,
Pete Bloomberg,
Joel Stein,
Jackie Liu,
and Ronnie Mickelson.
And of course, I'm Evan Kleiman. I'll be back next week with more good food.